From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the March 2024 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Before the Codebreakers. Bletchley Park is famous as the home of World War II codebreaking, but what was there before the Government Code and Cipher School moved in? Who built Bletchley Park? And what remains of the pre-war country estate. In this episode, research historian Dr. David Kenyon and head of content, Erica Munro, examine the people who made Bletchley Park their home prior to World War II. Sir Herbert Leon and his family bought, expanded, and lived in the now familiar mansion, stamping their individual style on the design of the building and the estate. Surviving historical records shed an intriguing light on the Leons, their philanthropy, interests and impact on the local community. We also hear from Professor Abigail Green of Brasenose College, Oxford University, an expert on Jewish country houses, to discover more about the social context of the family who made Bletchley Park.
We're outside at Bletchley Park, and there's a Victorian mansion here that obviously predates World War II. David, what is it that we can see here where we're standing that was here before the Codebreakers arrived?
Well, before the site's taken over by GCNCS, this is essentially a Victorian country estate. And so we're standing in the formal gardens. There's the very distinctive mansion just over there. People love it or hate it. And you have to imagine beyond that was a typical country estate of agricultural land and farms and cottages and all of the things you'd expect in that Victorian world.
All property that was managed by the people that lived in the house here. And the gardens we're standing in, the formal gardens, are obviously full of visitors and school groups at the moment. Is what we see here very similar to what would have been here in Victorian times?
Very much so. One of the wonderful things about the estate that we have now are the mature trees, and there's a whole series of specimen trees here which were part of the original Leon landscape and have survived right through.
And the lake that's in the middle of the site, which visitors can see today, was that here when the house was first built?
Yes, I believe the lake is actually much older and predates the house by some time, because there was an earlier house which was on the grass in front of us here, and that goes back to the 1700s. And then in the early Victorian period, a house was built where the current mansion is, and then the mansion as we see it today was massively restored in the 1880s and altered.
Tell us more about that restoration. Over the front door of the mansion, there is a monogram of three letters, and that relates to the family that built the mansion?
Yes. Over the door, you see HSL and 1883, mm-hmm. and that is Herbert Samuel Leon. He bought the property in 1883. The house had previously been bought a few years before by an architect called Seccombe, and he was in the process of remodeling it in order to sell it. He wasn't planning to live in it. He bought it as a project, if you like.
Right.
In 1883, Herbert Leon buys the property and, as far as we know, has a significant influence on how it's actually finished off. And so the property we see now, even though it's designed to look as if it's been built over a number of years, is actually a single build, or two builds, a build in 1883, and then there are some minor changes in 1906. But basically, we're looking at Herbert Leon's vision of a country house in 1883.
And what features can we see on the front of this mansion that are particularly Herbert Leon's ideas?
Some of this is speculation. We obviously don't have Herbert Leon's account of any of this, but my understanding is that the intent was to create a house that wasn't formally designed like a sort of four-square Georgian country mansion, but was rather something that looked like it had evolved organically over a number of years. And so you have a variety of architectural styles, and we have the green dome over the garden room at one end, and that's rather awkwardly abutting one of the gable ends of the main house. So it looks like it's a later addition. Actually, it's part of the same build.
All cunningly designed.
Yeah, and then you have medievally looking bits and Tudor bits and other later bits, but actually the mix of architectural styles is deliberate. and is intended to create that sense of history, which it didn't have.
Right. So it's all of the same sort of period. I mean, the stone is all similar colour, but it's thoroughly designed to be an illusion, effectively. They had an architect come in for that reason.
Yes, it is an illusion. Herbert had made his money on the stock market, and so he is new money in some sense. But when he moves here, he is wanting to present the image of somebody who is an established country family. This is their seat, is the term people use, even though it's actually brand new.
Mm-hmm. We'll find out a little bit more about Herbert Leon shortly, but I also wanted to find out about other properties. So a lot of work went on in this house. They weren't living here while the work was going on, surely?
No. Herbert, originally, his parents are based in London. He comes from London. For a while, they had a house in Leighton Buzzard, or in Linslade. But they had a house in Linslade, which he and his second wife, Fanny, moved to in the 1870s. And presumably, from a base in Leighton Buzzard, Bletchley Park was nearby.
That makes sense.
And so they're looking to settle in the area. But and they, at that point, in 1883, their children are 3 and 5 years old or something like that. So they've got a young family. And we think of Herbert and Fanny in their later years, because they were photographed in the 1920s as him as a sort of grandee of Parliament and everything else. But if you go back to 1880, you're talking about essentially a young couple with young children looking to settle down and make their home, but only doing it with a great deal of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've mentioned that a lot of the gardens that we can see here were here in the Victorian era, but you also mentioned there's stuff behind the mansion. But I know it's actually quite hard to get behind the mansion because there's housing there right now. How much of the estate that the Leons built and developed has been lost over time?
Quite a substantial part has been lost. The first phase of loss, if you like, takes place during the war, because when GC&CS move here in 1938, they start building the famous huts, and then, of course, they go on to build the blocks. So there are key features of the Leon landscape which we've lost. For example, Hut 4 right next to the mansion just over there. Previously, that was a rather lovely rose garden. And if you'd been in the library, you'd have looked out onto this rose garden. Hut 4 was built in the summer of 1939. So when the first codebreakers arrived, when the naval section moved into the library, that view would already have gone. They'd already have been looking at a hut at that point.
Right.
But there was a rose garden, and we have a family album from the Leons from the early 20th century, and there's numerous photographs of them sitting out in garden chairs on that lawn. Also, over the far side, as we look to the north, where Hut 10 is now, there was a hedge maze
yes,
over there.
Yes, of course.
Which is quite exciting for us, because we talk about code breaking in terms of kind of puzzles and mental challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that there was a maze here,
mm-hmm,
I don't know, it makes a sort of connection in some way.
Was that here when the first code breakers arrived?
That was still here, because Hut 10 wasn't built till later. So some of the early code breakers remember the maze. Then, of course, the blocks were built, but the majority of the blocks A and B, sit within the garden landscape. But immediately behind blocks A and B to the north, there was a ha-ha. For the benefit of our listeners who are not familiar with garden architecture, basically you have your lawn and then you have a ditch, and one side is a wall and the other side is a slope of earth. And the idea is that the cows can walk across, but they can't climb the wall.
Makes sense.
But when you're sitting on your lawn, it looks like a
seamless
continuous
view.
Vista.
Right.
And these are a common feature of country houses. So there was a ha-ha running along that side. And much of the 1942 onwards build happens on what were essentially agricultural fields beyond. So blocks A and B are within the garden, but blocks C, D, E, F, G and H are all in what was essentially fields.
And the estate was much larger than that. There was a cricket pavilion, there was home farm, there were cottages.
Behind us down here to the south, there was a very large cricket field and sort of recreation ground would be the modern term, with a wooden cricket pavilion, sports pavilion on the far side. And home farm still exists. This is the other aspect of the landscape that's disappeared, is we are now within the visitor area encompassed by housing. And all of that housing is post-war in various phases.
Yeah.
So you have to imagine that at that time there was no Milton Keynes. There would have been endless fields, essentially.
But the estate as the Leons owned, it wasn't that entire estate that got taken over by the government. It was a smaller parcel of that, wasn't it?
In 1938, Hugh Sinclair buys essentially just the formal garden we can see here, the mansion and the stable yard. All of the agricultural land was sold off in separate lots, which were bought by other people and continued to be farmland. But then as the war progresses and GC&CS grows and they need more land, they requisition fields adjacent. And many of the blocks are built on that subsequently requisitioned land rather than within the original purchase. And what's interesting is they could have potentially removed all these trees, you know, backfilled the lake,
yep,
built a lot of the code-breaking buildings, within that footprint, but they don't. And there is some suggestion that Alistair Denison, at least, wanted to keep the garden because he saw it had a role in the site for people to be able to come out of their hut and,
you know, welfare purposes.
For welfare purposes, yeah, people to come out and walk around and enjoy the garden. And a lot of veterans talk about being able to enjoy the grounds. Cynics say that you can see none of the huts from his office window, but, you know.
Either way, thank goodness for that decision having been made.
Because we do have this wonderful Victorian garden still here.
Absolutely. Having said that, should we pop inside and talk more about Herbert Leon indoors?
That's a good idea.
Give us some background to this Herbert Leon that we've been talking about.
Herbert was born in 1850. He's the son of a Orthodox Jewish stockbroker in London, a man called George Leon. George Leon was a member of the Stock Exchange and ran a firm with his brother, naturally called Leon Brothers. And Herbert was brought up within that family, a very wealthy family. His father's estate, when his father died in 1885, the probate value of it was £104,000. Which is the equivalent of about 16 million today. So he was born into quite a lot of wealth. It would appear that he was educated at home. We don't have any record of him going to a public school or to university. And by the age of 18, he's already a member of the Stock Exchange. So he's clearly gone into the family business at an early age. And he very quickly builds up his own fortune portfolio in his own right, in addition to the wealth that in 1885 he inherits from his father. So a lot of money. He is particularly interested in the stock market in America, and he has a number of investments in activity in the US. One of the more interesting ones was the Anglo-American Telegraph Company, and this is at the period when the first telegraph cables are being laid across the Atlantic, which is a very interesting technological story in its own right, but he was astute enough to realize that there was going to be money in this. And actually, after he purchased Bletchley Park in 1883, while it was being modified, he spent quite a lot of that time in the US dealing with his other financial interests over there, kind of waiting for his house to be ready to move into.
And the house is obviously built for him and his family. Did he have a large family?
He has quite a large family, but he has sort of two families. Initially, at the age of 23, Herbert, or Sammy as he was known by his middle name, Sammy married a lady called Esther Beddington. And her family, although they have a very English-sounding name, they're another Jewish family. Her father was a big figure in Orthodox Judaism in London. He was associated with the founding of the Central Synagogue and with the creation of Willesden Jewish Cemetery, which we will come back to. So Sammy and Esther get married in 1873, and they have two children, Mabel, known as Kitty, and George. And George, of course, is the first son. He will be the son and heir later. We'll come back to him. Sadly, when George is born in 1875, Esther got septicemia and died. Esther's death certificate records her death from septicemia only a week after the date we know George was born. We don't know for certain, but it's a pretty likely conclusion that there were complications in childbirth that led to her death. So Sammy and Esther have two children. And then 5 years after Esther's death in 1880, Sammy remarried a lady called Fanny Higham, who was from another prominent family, also Jewish. And they had two more children, Margaret, who's born in 1881, and Reggie, who was born in 1882. So by the time you get to the purchase of Bletchley Park in 1883, Herbert Sammy is in his 30s. He has his new wife and four children, two of Esther's children and two of Fanny's children. So there would have been this sort of family group arriving at Bletchley Park.
I love the idea of quite a young family moving in here, and there's a lot of possibility. It's a newly developed house. I like to imagine that when I'm looking at the mansion today. I know that we focus a lot on the co-breaking stories, but it is interesting to think of this Victorian family with their children in petticoats enjoying the house and the grounds.
Absolutely. And we have really nice evidence of this in the following generation, because we have a photograph album in our collection starting in 1906. And by that point, it's photographs of Sammy's grandchildren.
Oh, right.
And again, it's by this time that sort of the Edwardian pre-First World War world, you've got all these children in sort of sailor suits and prams and dogs. But what you see is, certainly by that point, a very family-orientated world. There's these wonderful photographs of big teas out on the lawn and lots of dogs and ponies. And there's pictures of the grandchildren with tiny ponies in traps and dogs. And just you get this real feeling of a happy family.
And they entertained here at Bletchley Park as well.
This is the second thing you have to be aware of to properly understand the house that we're sitting in now. Because on the one hand, it's this family home for Fanny and the children. But also, Herbert is very involved both in business and in politics. Mm-hmm. And the house is designed to be a public space, a place where he can entertain. And he was known to entertain quite lavishly. And that in particular is he was involved with the Liberal Party and Liberal politics. For example, Lloyd George, who was famously Prime Minister during the First World War, he's a Liberal. He was known to visit the house on a number of occasions and be friends with Sammy. And so we're sitting in the dining room at the moment, and we have this wood-paneled dining room with a spectacular fireplace and very decorative roof. Towards the back of the house, there's a ballroom that's even more spectacular. We have this sort of linifold paneling and gold on the roof. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing space.
Yeah.
And these spaces are deliberately created so that Herbert can move and mingle with the great and the good of the times.
You say he was political. He was an MP, wasn't he?
Yes, he became an MP for Buckingham in 1891. That wasn't the year of a general election. There was a by-election in Buckingham because the previous sitting Tory MP had been convicted of procuring a girl under the age of 21 for immoral purposes.
Right. So scandal. So
that prompted a by-election. He was suspended from Parliament and Sammy was elected. Shortly after, there was a general election in 1892 and Sammy stood again and retained his seat at that election. He's not an MP for very long. This was a period of significant political instability, and there was another general election in 1895. And at that point, the Conservatives retook Buckingham and Herbert lost his seat. He didn't return to Parliament after that. He did run again in the 1906 general election, not for Buckingham, but for Handsworth in Staffordshire, mm-hmm. but was unsuccessful. So he never re-enters Parliament formally, but he's still very much involved with politics. He's very much involved with the Liberal Party. And later on in 1911, there's the possibility that Herbert might become a member of the House of Lords, because at that point, the political instability is continuing. The then Liberal Prime Minister, Herbert Asquith, was concerned that the House of Lords tended to be dominated by Conservatives. And he actually threatens to create enough Liberal peers to outvote them, basically.
To stuff the House of Lords with his supporters.
Right. And Herbert Leon is one of the names on the list to become one of these loyal Liberal peers. Actually, the Conservative Party backed down because obviously they didn't want all of these new peers created, and they sort of bowed to Asquith's policies and the crisis was averted in a way. So what that means for the Leons is that Herbert doesn't become a member of the House of Lords. However, it's an interesting coincidence that in 1911, he gets his baronetcy. He becomes first Baronet Leon.
Is that a sort of consolation prize for
that? I get the sense that it's kind of a consolation prize. Yeah. It's like, I can't make you appear, but
here's a baronetcy for your troubles.
We have a rather lovely photograph in our collection of Herbert. We assume when he received his baronetcy, and he's in full court dress, which is black velvet breeches, stockings, a long tail coat. And there's a matching photograph of Fanny in a very elaborate sort of court dress. And our presumption is that those photographs date from his investiture as a baronet.
Mm-hmm. And rather than, say, a life peerage in the House of Lords, that being the baronet is something that is then passed to your
children. It is hereditary, yes.
So, to your heir.
So there is still a Baronet Leon mm-hmm. in the subsequent generations. George becomes Sir George when Herbert died in 1926.
Going back to Herbert's political career, between the part when he was an MP and when he was given his baronetcy in 1911, he sort of moved into more civic work and community duties, I suppose is how I'd describe them, working with local government rather than national, didn't he?
He did, yes. He became very involved in local politics. He sat on Buckinghamshire County Council. He was chair of the finance committee there. He was a member of Bletchley Town Council in 1903. And then later, when it was renamed, it became the Bletchley Urban District Council. He was chairman of that. He also sat on the bench as a magistrate. In many ways, as a substantial local landowner in Bletchley, which was a relatively small town, these are the kind of obligations that you'd expect the local landowner to adopt. It's not something necessarily that he's done. He hasn't woken up one day and go, oh, I think it'd be interesting to be on the council. It would be kind of expected
of
him.
It's the duty of a grandee,
isn't it? It's the duty of a grandee in the area. But he does seem to go beyond simply doing it as a civic duty. He gets really engaged with the community. And there are examples in the newspapers of the time of not only his administrative interest in the community, but his genuine care for people. And he was prepared to spend his own money. In 1895, there was quite a severe agricultural depression, and there were a lot of people out of work. And of course, no welfare state in those days. And the newspaper records that he set up a fund and was the lead donor of the fund to create a soup kitchen in Fenny Stratford. And this was able to distribute basically bread and soup to the rural poor, who at that point were really struggling. He also purchased a plot of land on the other side of Bletchley from where we are now, which is still known as the Leon Rec. And this was basically, he created a public park, a recreation ground within the town at his own expense for the local community. So he's clearly going beyond his civic obligations as a local figure and putting his money where his mouth is and getting properly investing in the community.
We're sort of describing Herbert or Sammy as rather the hero here, all the good works that he did. Is there any evidence that people were critical about him, that perceived him in a negative way about either his politics or his civic work?
There is. If you read the newspapers from the times, there are a number of incidents where he's clearly not pleasing all of the people all the time. The Buckingham seat is contested between the Liberals and the Conservatives at each election, and the seat swings from one to the other. Prior to the 1895 general election, there's a very interesting article in the Bucks Times from somebody who clearly had no time for Herbert at all. And there's a column-length rant about how he's a disruptor and he has all these radical ideas to upset society, which the writer clearly doesn't think are appropriate. Some examples, one of the things Herbert was proposing was reform of the House of Lords.
Outrageous!
And, you know, nowadays, this is still a hot topic, but there's been a great deal of reform of the House of Lords over the years. And some of the ideas that he's proposing don't seem that peculiar nowadays, but at the time they were considered, you know, more or less, they're talking about revolution, you know. Things like the fact that you shouldn't be allowed to vote in more than one constituency in the same election. Because at that period, it was still possible to be on the electoral roll in different places and to vote in all those places.
If you had multiple properties.
So if you had many houses, you could get many votes, which we nowadays think of as completely...
Anti-democratic.
Anti-democratic.
Yes.
But at the time, this was, you know, it was considered fair enough. You know, how dare you suggest we can't vote in both places we live?
I'm with Herbert on that one.
I'm kind of with Herbert
on it as well, but it's clear that some of his views were progressive.
Right.
And this is a feature of the Liberal politics at the time, that there is progressive thinking.
Mr. Leon's programme. This is the age of programmes, and it was hardly to be expected that a gentleman of Mr. Leon's well-known character for push and parade would not take the first opportunity to instruct his government as to the way they should deal with the House of Lords in particular, and the House of Commons in general. Mr. Leon has issued his instructions. They appear in that particularly constructed amalgamation of Westminster Gazette and Northbrook's Liberal Association, in infusions bound in yellow, entitled The Northbrook's Democrat. Five of his measures are to be produced at once into the House of Commons, and in order to carry them, the closure, gag, guillotine, and time limits must be unmercifully used and put into force. There must be no discussion in the House of Commons. Mr. Leon is the centre of intelligence. What he gives his sanction to must be passed straight off with the help of the closure, guillotine and time limits.
Extract from the Northbrook's Times of the 21st of January, 1895.
So Herbert Samuel Leon, progressive, liberal. What more do we know about his character and his beliefs?
Well, interestingly, although his father was, as far as we're aware, an Orthodox practicing member of the Jewish faith, Sammy doesn't seem to take his religious observances very seriously. In fact, to the contrary, he describes himself as a rationalist. And in particular, from 1913 onwards, he was the chairman of the Rationalist Press Association. What this is an organisation which published books, essentially, but rationalism in the late 19th century was a movement around the idea that religion should not be front and centre in public life. Herbert and his rationalist friends were not dismissing religion, but they were saying religion is ultimately a matter of private faith, and you are free to have whatever religion you like, or no religion if you choose, but that's your kind of private matter, and people should be free to discuss religion and philosophy and morality without being censored, if you like, by a religious establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And the rationalist press is all about publishing books by thinkers who, if they'd gone to a mainstream publisher, the publisher would have turned that book down because they were worried about the criticism from the, quote, establishment, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
So the main purpose of the rationalist press is to allow a voice for those thinkers who were espousing these views. But it's a wider thing. It's not just a press. It's about a community of thinking and meetings. And so some of the things that Herbert is criticised for in the newspaper article that I referred to about the election. There's talk in there about the disestablishment of the church in Wales. And for those that aren't familiar with this, disestablishment in the UK is the idea that currently we have a state religion. We have the Church of England, and the king is the head of the church. Disestablishment is the idea that the church should be separated from the government and the crown, and that we should just have religions that exist separate from the state. The separation of church and state nowadays doesn't sound like such a terrifying idea, but in the late 19th century, this was radical. This was crazy talk. Where Herbert was talking about the disestablishment of the Church of Wales in particular, I think this reflects the idea. We're all familiar with the presence of a lot of nonconformity in Wales. It's the home of the chapel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a great many Welsh people are not members of the Church of Wales. They're nonconformists. So if anywhere in the UK needed a disestablished church, it is Wales. So Sammy has a good point.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, it would have been considered, you know, revolutionary radicalism in some people's eyes.
This Rationalist Press Association, though, that's not died out. That's become the Rationalist Association of today.
Yes. The movement and the ideas behind this continue, and a number of notable figures over the years have been involved. Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, and today Jonathan Miller is a member of the Rationalist Association. And so this idea that humanism, non-religiosity should be promoted hasn't gone away and absolutely continues.
And perhaps makes Herbert Leon's beliefs more familiar to us, less marginal, and something that we can understand perhaps a bit more.
You could almost describe him as ahead of his time in that sense, that he was espousing ideas that have become more fashionable since his death rather than less so. But it is an interesting juxtaposition with his presence within the British Jewish community. And it's clear that he was very closely involved with Jewish life on the social level and with other Jewish families, both in the area and nationally.
Mm-hmm.
So he is socially Jewish in that sense, even though he's not a practicing religious person. And even though he's a secularist, it is fair to describe Bletchley Park as a Jewish country house in that milieu.
To better understand what is meant by Jewish country house, and therefore to try and understand the Leons a little more, we've met with Professor Abigail Green of Brasenose College, Oxford. Abigail, can you explain to us what is meant by the phrase Jewish country house?
Well, I think it's got two meanings. Obviously, at a basic level, it means a country house owned by Jews or those of Jewish origin, but it's also a phenomenon which is a marker of Jewish emancipation, because before the mid-19th century, really, across Europe, Jewish residence was restricted often to urban ghettos, and in most places, Jews could not freely own freehold land. So although country houses were an important stepping stone into the British elite, in fact, it was something closed to people who were practicing Jews. So the Jewish country house is a hallmark of a changing society. Also, to call it Jewish doesn't mean it's not an English country house, because
yeah,
it's not an exclusive identity. The kind of Jews who acquired or built country houses, you know, were obviously wealthy. They mm-hmm. tended to be from a wealthy financial background, but they wouldn't have been aristocratic in origin in most cases, because the first Jewish aristocrat was Lord Rothschild in the 1880s.
And Sir Herbert Leon, as we know, was the first Baronet Leon as well.
Yeah, so baronets were a bit earlier in the 1830s. Isaac Lyon Goldsmith and Moses Montefiore, maybe the early 1840s, actually, they became baronets, but it was still quite a new phenomenon. So in the 18th century, if you were a Jew like Samson Gideon and you acquired a country house, if you wanted to found an aristocratic line, your child would have had to be brought up as a Christian.
Right. And the social kind of milieu of owners and those who lived in country houses that we can term Jewish country houses, I presume there was an established kind of social connection and network between these families?
Well, yes. I mean, I think timing is relevant. So, for example, often you get enclaves of members of the same family, like most famously the Rothschilds in the Vale of Aylesbury, who built houses in the same area, partly because then, for example, I mean, there was safety in numbers. I think that's the point. So they could, for instance, hunt together without fear of encountering prejudice from the established families. But also, and I think this is relevant to the Lyons, these families, the Jewish families, they were city families, really. The Lyons were a city family. They tended to marry into other Jewish business families with roots in the city or elsewhere in continental Europe for reasons which may have reflected their business interests as much as anything else.
Right. In what ways do you think Bletchley Park fits into that description of Jewish country house? And are there ways that you think it perhaps doesn't fit in?
Actually, I think it just is a Jewish country house
because
Sir Herbert Lyon, you know, he clearly was Jewish. He was a secular Jew, but that was not so uncommon in that period. And his first wife was a Beddington. I mean, the Beddingtons are quite an interesting family because they changed their name. They anglicized their name. But there was a famous rhyme about them. They may change their name from Moses, but they cannot change their noses. And I think that reflects the way in which these families were perceived, so they could acquire the trappings of Englishness, but nevertheless, they continued to be received as Jewish. And even, I mean, this doesn't in fact apply to the Lyons, but even people like Disraeli or the Countess Frances Waldegrave, who had been brought up as Christians, but had Jewish parents, were often received as Jewish. So I feel like Bletchley is Jewish in two different ways. Firstly, it's Jewish because Sir Herbert, his children by his first wife and his second wife, who is herself of Jewish origin, you know, are moving in a Jewish context, even as they also move in an English context, but also because it will have been perceived that way as well.
Yeah. And what do you think is the outstanding characteristic of that experience that they would have had? Is it that they were identified by local residents as Jewish, or is it that they were perhaps new to the country house ownership, or that they were perceived as outsiders?
Well, obviously, this is an era in which many kinds of people are making new money and moving into the countryside as part of their pathway to social mobility and maybe joining the aristocracy. I think what's distinctive about this Jewish milieu, Jewish country house families, is how I tend to think of them, is that they had a kind of hybrid identity. They were at home in both worlds. So they would have been quite comfortable doing Jewish things, but they would also have been quite comfortable doing English or European things.
And Sir Herbert Lyon, being a rationalist, was that also something that you could see across Jews who lived in country houses, that kind of social group, or was that quite unusual?
I think it kind of varies. I mean, these families often felt a sense of obligation to Jews in London, but that didn't mean to say that they didn't move away from themselves from Orthodox Jewish practice. And we can think of many other examples, like, for instance, David Lionel Salomon's, of people who regarded themselves as secularists, but nevertheless didn't move away completely from a Jewish identity. I mean, these people don't convert. And clearly, being secular or rationalist is not really a neutral category.
Mm-hmm.
To be a secular Jew is different from being a secular Christian.
You had remarked to me before we began recording here about the fact that Herbert Lyon had some beliefs more reminiscent of those in continental Europe, perhaps, than British Jews in terms of his rationalism, or his liberalism, perhaps.
It's more in terms of his liberalism. So in Britain, you know, Anglicanism was very attached to the landed aristocracy. And so aristocratic Jewish families like the Rothschilds or the Montefiores kind of tended to operate in a similar but Jewish vein in terms of how they operated culturally. And liberals, I mean, so more often Jewish politicians were liberal than conservative. And in Britain, liberalism was very associated with evangelicalism and nonconformity. So it was quite religious. But in continental Europe, things were quite different, partly because of the Catholic Church. And often liberals tended to be secularists, and Jewish liberals tended to be secularists as well. So I think that Sir Herbert Lyon as a rationalist wasn't completely unusual in a British context, but he would have been more normal in a continental European context.
Do you think that there was a particular time that we can identify when this idea of Jewish country houses started to die out? Was there a particular period of time where we can say this was the end of the Jewish country house?
Well, I'm not sure it's so different from the age of the country house in general. I think the starting point is different,
yeah,
but the end point, maybe not so much. I mean, obviously, in continental Europe, you have the Holocaust and the 1930s and the depredations of Jewish property in Nazi Europe. In Britain, you don't have that phenomenon, but nevertheless, country houses are taken over during the war, and many people don't go back into them. So I don't know whether it's so different in Britain from the age of the country house in general as an endpoint. The cousinhood, this network of elite Jewish families who tended to intermarry, certainly persisted into the later 20th century, but maybe became gradually detached from the world of the country house.
So our experience that we've seen with Bletchley Park being sold off,
I think it was quite normal.
Yes. Standard for families of all backgrounds as well at that kind of time. That makes a lot of sense. And actually, when Bletchley Park was passed to a property developer, it feels like perhaps there wasn't the need for other families, Jewish or otherwise, to be getting hold of these kinds of properties around the country, that things had just changed at that point. Is there anything else about Bletchley Park specifically that strikes you as very typical of a Jewish country house?
I'm not an architectural historian, but Bletchley Park, you know, I don't know how normal it is as a building of its kind, but it's a building which on the outside does look quite English, but on the inside, not so much. You know, one might say that actually about somewhere like maybe Port Limpney, which has these striking interiors, or some of the Sassoon properties. So I suppose, you know, it's worth considering the other kinds of cultural influence which entered into the making of Bletchley Park. I mean, I don't know that I would read it as purely about anglicisation or cultural assimilation, because it just doesn't feel very much like an English country house in the interior.
It's also, it's quite modest in size. The estate was not small, but compared to somewhere like obviously Wadston or somewhere much, much, much grander. But it was also built all at one time to look as if it had grown more organically over time and established itself. And I wonder if that reflects the fact that, as you were saying, the history of the Jewish country house has a later start date.
It's a kind of new money phenomenon,
yes,
I think.
Yeah.
I do think, from what I remember, for example, the Lyons brought the railway to Bletchley Park, and that was quite common. Mm-hmm. Actually, I could think of lots of examples of that. I think its location within easy reach of London is quite typical, because these houses, rarely do we find them in Yorkshire. More commonly, we find them in the home counties. And the philanthropic engagement with the village is quite normal as well. I mean, you find that everywhere. Obviously, we think of a kind of aristocratic tradition of noblesse oblige, but the old landed aristocracy obviously actually have less wealth in some ways, or less confidence that they will be able to maintain it. And so they might not be spending money on philanthropy in quite the same way.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I wouldn't want to say that was just a Jewish thing. I think it's a new money thing.
Yeah.
I guess when we think about this house, it's important to understand that this is an age of political and social anti-Semitism in Britain, as well as continental Europe, particularly, in fact, the Edwardian era, and that rich Jews, like the Lyons, rich city Jews, were particular targets. So when we're thinking about their experiences and how they fitted into society, we can't understand it unless we think about that as well.
Abigail, thank you so much. This has been a great insight into an area that's perhaps less understood about Bletchley Park. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming back to Herbert Lyons' personal life, his interest, you've mentioned that he enjoyed spending time with his family, and we've spoken about the big estate here at Bletchley Park. What do we know about what he did in his free time or what he enjoyed doing?
Well, to judge by the photograph album we have from 1906, he was a very keen golfer. There's a number of family trips in that album where they've gone off, and there's pictures of him and his spectacular golf swing in Ireland, in Scotland, all around the place, playing golf, and he seems to be very keen on that. But also within the estate here at Bletchley, he was very, again, interested not just in owning the estate, but actually how the estate is run and agriculture and livestock in particular. He had prize-winning herds of both sheep and cattle. and he took a great deal of interest in cattle. This fact kind of surprised me when it came out that in 1916, he won first prize and reserve champion at the Buenos Aires International Exhibition with a shorthorn bull calf named Bletchley Promise.
In Buenos Aires, and you go, in South America.
In Buenos Aires, in South America, in the middle of World War One.
Wow.
He is sending a prize cow to South America.
To be judged.
That's commitment.
That is.
He's not just casually interested in livestock. That is going full cow.
It won. So for good reason, he sent it out there.
And he did well out of it because he then sold the bull for £4,366, 16 shillings and sixpence, mm-hmm. which is the equivalent of about £300,000 today. So
that's a lot for an animal.
This was an interest, but also a business.
Yeah.
And again, the photograph album, in addition to photographs of dogs and children, there are quite a lot of photographs of cattle and bulls and members of the family standing next to prize cows. And we'll come on to talk about Fanny in a bit, but she was also very engaged with agriculture and with animal breeding and the rest of it. Mm-hmm. Sammy's also very interested in plants. He had a orchid house here at Bletchley Park. We don't know exactly where it is, but there used to be a large kitchen garden behind where the garages are now on the west side of the site. All of that has now become housing, so there's nothing surviving over there.
Right.
But I imagine the orchid house would have been over there somewhere. And it wasn't just a greenhouse. It was specially heated, and there were several members of staff whose only job was to look after the orchids.
Wow.
And even today, orchid breeding is a specialist hobby in its own right. And he was very proud of it. And apparently when people came to stay, one of the things they were expected to do was go and admire the orchids. It might have been easier than going and admiring the prize bulls.
Yeah, but, true.
But certainly it was something he was very proud of.
I'm very aware that we've spoken quite a lot about Herbert Leon, but we've been saying there was a family living here. It may be because, unfortunately, history records a lot more about men than it does about women. And we are slightly suffering from that, from the Victorian era and the early 20th century. But I want to turn our focus to Fanny Leon, Lady Leon, as well, because she has an important part to play in the history of Bletchley Park. What can you tell us about her, her background, and her influence on the local area?
We absolutely have to talk about Fanny Higham because she is very much part of the story, and her influence on both Bletchley Park and the town of Bletchley is very significant. She stands out, in addition to Herbert, as a significant public figure in this area. As we've been discussing, she was from the Higham family and her mother was from the Moses family. So she is from the Jewish community. She was about 10 years younger than Herbert. She and Herbert have the two further children. While Herbert was alive up until 1926, it's difficult to see Fanny in her own right. She tends to fall under the shadow of Herbert, because he's sort of the head of the family, if you like.
In terms of the documentary evidence.
In terms of the documentary evidence.
Yeah, yeah.
But we know of a number of activities that she was already engaged in throughout that time, in particular her interest in agriculture and her interest in the local community. But she really comes to prominence after his death, because when she takes over the estate as Lady Leon, she takes over a lot of Herbert's roles within the local council. She also becomes a magistrate on the local bench.
Is it unusual to have female magistrates in the 20s and 30s?
It was certainly a lot less common than it is now, but I don't think it would have been particularly revolutionary at the time. It wasn't, you know. I don't think she was breaking any particular barriers by doing it. But,
okay.
But it's not necessarily something that the average, you know, widow of a local landowner might choose to do.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, she's on the bench at the same time when he is. She starts out in 1921 when he's still alive. So she's developing her own public profile while he's still alive. But certainly after his death, she moves up to, as I say, to sit on the council, and she becomes very engaged in agricultural affairs locally. She was involved with the Farmers' Union and used to host events here at Bletchley Park for the Farmers' Union and the local agricultural community. She was also keenly interested in health and child welfare, and she was governor of Bedford Hospital, and she was vice president of Northampton General Hospital. So she's getting involved with healthcare, and it's not explicit in the documentation I've read, but I get the sense that her interest in not only healthcare generally, but women's health and reproductive health and children was something that she had a particular interest in and is very supportive of. So she seems like a very, I don't know if kind is the right word, but very, you know, invested in welfare. Ironically, that comes at the same time people say that she wasn't particularly fun.
She didn't smile a lot.
She didn't do a lot of smiling or joke cracking. She was a very serious lady.
Okay.
And I suspect you know, it would be a cliche, but you can imagine somebody quite Victorian in the way we use the term nowadays, quite formal, quite not stuffy, but serious.
Yeah.
You didn't lark about with Fanny.
Well, it does sound like she was quite important, that she had many fingers in many important pies, and that she was busy doing her civic duty quite a lot as well. So I presume people also deferred to her as Lady Leon.
Yes. She's also on the local education committees on the council, was very engaged with local education. And again, this comes back to child welfare and all that. And this, of course, is reflected in the fact that the Leon School in Bletchley is there to this day. I went past it on the train this morning. And that is named for Herbert and Fanny Leon, who were huge benefactors and supporters of local education.
You were saying about children's welfare and being interested in children. She ran a local club for local children.
Yes, this is one of her more interesting activities. We see, on the one hand, she's interested in education and children, and on the other hand, she's very interested in agriculture. Like her husband, she's interested in cattle breeding and all the rest of it. And those two strands come together in the Bletchley Young Farmers Calf Club, which Fanny supported. It took place every Saturday in the cricket pavilion to the south of the site. And the basic principle was local children could join the calf club and they would be given a calf. They would be loaned a calf. And then their job was to look after that calf for the next 12 months. And the following year, the calf would come back and there would be a competition. And the idea was that each child would be judged on how well they had reared that calf, how healthy it was, how much it had grown, how fat it was, you know, all the criteria for calves. I don't know what they are. And the children would come on a Saturday morning to the cricket pavilion to be given coaching and advice on how to raise the animal. And there are descriptions of the fact that Fanny and her dogs, she would set off across the recreation ground on a Saturday morning to go and see the children and the calves and see how they were all getting on. And there are surviving photographs of the parade of the calf club.
I mean, that sounds like a community engagement and community interest, but also very educational, instructive, positive for their welfare kind of organised event. So it sounds like she's keyed into what the local needs are as well, teaching children agricultural skills for the future, as well as keeping them entertained or keeping them busy at the same time.
You get the sense that she's all about improvement of the young.
Improvement with a capital I, absolutely. Was Fanny Leon, like her husband, very political?
I believe she was, yes. Again, it's hard to see that explicitly until she sort of steps out from Herbert's shadow in 1926. But in 1927, after he died, she took over as president of the North Buckinghamshire Liberal Association. So she is completely embedded in the Liberal Party at that point. She resigned in 1935. By that point, she was getting quite ill. She died in 1937. And at that time, the chairman of the association commented on her contribution. And it's clear that they were very fond of her. He wrote, "Your great kindness during the latter part of the last half century will always remain in our memories. Your sane and tactful guidance, together with your unfailing generosity in allowing Bletchley Park to be, as it were, the home in the true sense of local liberalism, this will cause your name, together with that of Sir Herbert, ever to be held in fragrant remembrance by all liberals in North Bucks."
What a wonderful way of putting it.
I love the phrase fragrant remembrance.
Absolutely.
But it's easy to giggle at that a little bit, but at the same time, there's clearly...
There's real affection.
There's real affection for both her and Herbert there from the local liberal community. Clearly, she has been a player in her own right throughout that time, as well as Herbert. And a lot of this comes out when Fanny died in 1937. There is a lengthy obituary in the Bletchley Industry Gazette. Inevitably, when the local grandee dies, the paper is going to write something nice about them. You know, I know the dead can't sue, but you expect a certain amount of outpouring of public sympathy. But the article is really striking by how much affection there seems to have been for her in the community. And the article runs over several pages. This is why we know so much about her, because it goes through all the different spheres of activity. She's in the hospital, the council, the schools, all the liberals, all of these different things. And there are quotes and contributions in there from all sorts of different people saying this was a very kind and important lady.
Death of Fanny, Lady Leon. Bletchley's greatest benefactress. Her life of good works, full details. Fanny, Lady Leon, can, without dispute, be described as Bletchley's greatest benefactress. Her generosity towards and interest in many of the town's organisations are well known. What will never be fully known are those many acts of kindness which have so endeared her to the people of Bletchley. Appreciations of her life appear on our front page and in our leading article. Here, we endeavour to give a complete sketch of her many activities, together with some tributes which have been paid to her.
Extract from the Bletchley District Gazette of the 23rd of January, 1937.
We've learned that Fanny Lyon died in 1937. Herbert Lyon died 11 years prior. Are they buried locally here to Bletchley Park?
No, they're not. And this is one of the aspects of Herbert and Fanny Lyon that goes back to Herbert's rationalist beliefs and those aspects of his character. He was cremated at Golders Green Crematorium.
In London.
And that's, for someone of a Jewish background, cremation is, or certainly was in those days, very unusual. It's not part of the normal Jewish burial rite. Fanny, in due course, was also cremated at Golders Green. The fact that it's a crematorium in Golders Green, although we think of Golders Green nowadays as a Jewish community, and indeed there is a very large Jewish cemetery in Golders Green directly opposite the crematorium. Actually, the crematorium is for all faiths and none, so it's not a specifically, it can't be a Jewish crematorium because cremation is not part of the Jewish rite. But equally, at that period, cremation, even by 1926, wasn't as common as it is today. So there weren't as many crematoria, so it's likely coincidence that the crematorium happens to be in Golders Green.
Right.
At this point, there's a bit of a mystery because I've spent some time trying to track down whether Herbert and Fanny Lyon are memorialised anywhere, whether their ashes were formally deposited anywhere. We know they're not in Golders Green Cemetery, they're not in Willesden Cemetery. And interestingly, Willesden Jewish Cemetery was founded by Herbert's first wife, Esther's father, Beddington. He set up Willesden Cemetery, and rather sadly, he then buries his daughter in the cemetery 2 years after it's created. Mm. She was buried there in 1875, and we do have photographs of her memorial there.
Esther Lyon, née Beddington.
Esther Lyon, née Beddington, and it mentions wife of Herbert Lyon. But that's the only family memorial that I've been able to track down. This quest isn't finished yet. I'm still trying to find out if Herbert and Fanny's ashes are somewhere else.
We appeal to listeners if they
have
more information.
Yes, if anyone knows the answer to this, do let us know.
Pop us an email to our inquiries email address.
I mean, for all I know, they might have been scattered out there on the lawn. I don't think that was the case because in 1937, relatively shortly after Fanny died, the estate was sold. George, who was the heir, Esther's son from 1875, he inherited both the baronetcy and Bletchley Park. But at that point, he and his wife, Millie, were living at Warfield House in Berkshire, and he had no interest in or use for the Bletchley Park estate. So he put the whole thing up for auction. It's not bought directly from George by Hugh Sinclair and GC&CS. There's actually an intermediary because in 1937, several parts of the estate were bought by Hubert Faulkner, who was a local property developer. And his plan was to build housing here for Bletchley Station, which of course is just across the road. And there are aerial photographs in the English Heritage Collection, which were taken in 1937. And they're quite interesting because they are of the site at that little tiny gap between after the Lyon family have sold it, but before GC&CS and SIS have bought it. And in those images, you can see demolitions going on in the stable yard where Faulkner was starting to remodel the site. And some of the buildings in the stable yard, the form they are in now, reflects the fact that Faulkner had converted them. But obviously his plans for the site halt when Hugh Sinclair comes along and buys the site off him.
And we've said this in previous podcasts, that one of the great benefits of Bletchley Park was its availability, the fact that it was vacant at the time, they're not having to requisition it or move a family out. It was there under development by Faulkner.
Yes, it was an empty property, essentially. Interestingly, the story, as I understand it, is that Sinclair paid Faulkner a sum very similar to what Faulkner had paid to buy the lots in the first place. So Faulkner didn't make any money at that point, but he becomes head of site works. I can't remember what his exact title is, but he remains on site throughout the war and is the principal contractor for all of the huts and blocks subsequently. So he clearly did all right out of it. And he remains associated with the site throughout the war.
And whilst the Lyon family, the information that we know about them, admittedly limited, is so interesting in understanding why the mansion looks like it does and what was here beforehand. Obviously, our focus that visitors will experience when they're here is that Second World War story. That's the big impactful thing that we're able to focus on. But we are able to refer back to the Lyon family and also that monogram that sits above the door that the codebreakers would have walked underneath, that visitors, when they visit the site, walk underneath. That very tangible, visible legacy of the Lyons right there on the front door that we can still see today.
Very much so. And the other thing that GCNCS does completely accidentally is preserve the mansion and the gardens, the immediate grounds of Bletchley Park to today. Had Hugh Sinclair not decided to buy it, you'd be talking about a lost Jewish country house because Faulkner would have demolished it.
So the Leon's
the
legacy.
Leon's legacy would have disappeared.
Yeah.
So there's an ironic sort of coincidence that the fact that they stuck a load of huts up and did code-breaking here preserves the Leon story in a way that it perhaps wouldn't have been preserved otherwise.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.